Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Matt Dameron. I represent plaintiffs and judges Peggy Stevens McGraw and Sam Jones. And Judge Jones is here with us today in the gallery. We appreciate his presence. In this case, plaintiffs seek a simple and straightforward remedy. Apply and enforce the plain language of the 2010 schedule as written. Nothing less, nothing more. Defendants, on the other hand, seek extraordinary remedies. The state asks this court to broadly expand the doctrine of sovereign immunity. Mosers asks this court to find the 2010 schedule of compensation to be unconstitutional. And both defendants advocate for a hyper-technical reading of the 2010 schedule of compensation that is not supported by the plain language. Defendants' positions are contrary to Missouri law. They are contrary to similar cases that have considered analogous categories of judges paid under similar types of formulas. And again, they contravene the plain language of the 2010 schedule. So let's turn to the plain language of the 2010 schedule. First and foremost, this is not a retroactive pay increase. Plaintiffs are not asking this court to apply the 2010 schedule of compensation retroactively. If we look at the sort of origins of this case, we find those in Beer and Barker, the federal litigation. Those applied back pay for federal judges going back to 2003. But in this case, plaintiffs seek back pay compensation only from July 1, 2012, the effective date of the 2010 schedule of compensation, i.e. not retroactive, and until June 30, 2014. So a narrow window of time. So looking at the plain language, first and foremost, we start with Article 13, Section 3, which creates the Citizens Commission on Compensation. Section 8, which is primarily our focus in this litigation, it speaks of compensation. But in Section 1, compensation is defined to include the salary rate established by law. And that term is important. Salary is important because salary is what you're entitled to for work during a given time period, and it is different from wages. So a person may be paid a particular number, but be entitled to more by virtue of their salary. So the term salary is incorporated into Section 8, where it talks about compensation. And then, of course, we see that term carried forward in the 2010 schedule of compensation, where the commission recommended and the legislature adopted a formula that simply said percentage, and the commission established that percentage number, times the federal judicial salary equals Missouri judicial salary. And so that term has meaning. And we see that in Beer and Barker, because in Beer and Barker, where the court talks about back pay, where the courts talk about the entitlement of federal judges to adjusted salaries, they use that term, salary, throughout. And this court need only look at Cornish. Cornish is the decision that took Beer and Barker. It is straight on point with this case. Cornish took Beer and Barker and extended it to a category of judges who are paid under a formula set forth, much like Missouri judges. It's a different percentage, but it's basically the same calculation, 92% of a federal district judge's salary. That's at 28 U.S.C. 153, and it's also in the appendix to appellant's opening brief at 62 and 63. In Cornish, the government there said, look, bankruptcy judges are not entitled to the compensation clause in Article 3 of the United States Constitution. The DOJ argued there that bankruptcy judges were not entitled to Article 3 compensation clause, and they were not entitled to the protections of the Ethics Reform Act of 1989. Cornish rejected those arguments and said, look, this is a perfectly straightforward statutory claim, and it was based on a plain reading of the statute. That is all we ask Missouri courts to do, adopt and incorporate a plain reading of the statute. So,
are you bringing a contract claim or a tort claim?
We're bringing a statutory claim under the 2010 schedule. And it doesn't sound in tort, Your Honor. You know, we talk about DiCarlo in the briefing, which was a contract case. Frankly, the facts of this case are better than DiCarlo, because here the state, by law, has conferred a benefit on Missouri judges. And by virtue of not rejecting the 2010 schedule, by virtue of the 2014 commission readopting, ratifying, reincorporating the 2010 schedule and that calculation for compensation, Missouri has conferred a benefit on Missouri judges. So in that respect, it's a statutory claim. And the 2010 schedule obviously is not a statute, but it has the force of law. And Weinstock recognized that. Now, Weinstock had a different result for different circumstances. But the plain language of the 2010 schedule creates a right. And the issue in this case, one of the primary issues in this case, is do plaintiffs have a remedy? The answer is yes. Unequivocally yes, and I don't think this court can reach a different conclusion on that question. First, the state concedes that the 2010 schedule, by virtue of being promulgated under Article 13, Section 3, the state concedes it is enforceable. There's no question about that. If you look at the Weinstock chronology, that's clear. Weinstock was decided in 1999. In 2002, the Commission on Compensation added a paragraph talking about the future of the commission, and it said, look, the state of Missouri has a choice. It can do one of two things. It can either make the schedules that are promulgated under this binding on the General Assembly, or it can abolish the commission. And here we have a great example of Missouri listening. The General Assembly listened. The voters of Missouri listened. And in 2006, HJR 55, the state of Missouri initiated across the street at the state capitol, said, we're going to remove the phrase subject to appropriation. And remember, that was the key operative language in Weinstock that precluded recovery in that case for Judge Weinstock. And the state legislature initiated the process and said, we're going to take that language out. And the voters of Missouri ratified that decision in a popular vote in November of 2006. And the only inference we can draw from that, in light of Weinstock, in light of the 2002 commission report, and in light of the 2006 amendment, the only inference we can draw from that is that the state intended to waive its sovereign immunity. And the state virtually concedes that in its brief. And remember, too, that the 2006 amendment, that's not a wholesale revision of Article 13, Section 3. I would implore the court to go look at it, because it is a surgical, precise edit to Article 13, Section 3. I think it changed the Citizens Commission from singular to plural. I think it added one other sentence, and then it struck those three words. That is the import of the 2006 amendment. It is significant. So the plain language of the 2010 schedule gives us a right. Weinstock chronology certainly gives us a right. And the question is, now, what's the remedy? And are plaintiffs entitled to money damages? And the state, in its brief, takes a position the plaintiffs are not, because somehow, by virtue of deleting the words subject to appropriation, that the state has somehow reserved its sovereign immunity vis-a-vis money damages. The only cases cited.
You're asking for back pay, not for other damages. Is that correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
You're asking to get the salary you believe you were entitled to.
Correct, Your Honor. Correct, Your Honor. And so, the only cases cited by the state for that proposition are all Hancock Amendment cases. And those are great cases for the state, but the Hancock Amendment is very, very different from the facts of this case. Recovery under the Hancock Amendment is governed by Article 10, Section 23 of the Constitution, the title of which says Actions for Interpretations on Limitations. So just the title of Article 10, Section 23 contemplates declaratory judgment. Then you get into the body of Article 10, Section 23, and it delineates that, look, if someone is successful in challenging a provision under the Hancock Amendment, you're entitled to attorney's fees and costs. So I actually think the Hancock Amendment cases help us. I think they empower plaintiffs in this case, because if the state automatically reserves its sovereign immunity for money damages, then why is that provision necessary? Why is Article 10, Section 23 even necessary? Why did the state feel compelled to say, well, this is what you're entitled to? Because it's a broad waiver. Also think about what the state's argument, how that would impact sue and be sued statutes. Moser's is a great example. Moser's is subject to a sue and be sued provision, common in Missouri law. And that's typically the way courts interpret the state to waive a sovereign immunity. Those statutes, none of them talk about how sue and be sued for these categories of damages. The state, you know, Moser's, MoDOT, whatever entity we're talking about, they don't say sue and be sued for these particular categories of damages. They just say sue and be sued. So if this court adopts the state's argument, the sue and be sued language means the state can never be liable for money damages unless it explicitly says it. That is contrary to Missouri law. And other than the Hancock Amendment cases, other than Fort Zumwalt, which is very distinguishable, the state doesn't even identify any case law supporting that proposition. That would be a broad expansion of sovereign immunity in the state of Missouri, and it's contrary to Missouri law. Finally, I'll turn briefly to the constitutional claims raised by Moser's. Moser's argues that the 2010 schedule contravenes the Missouri Constitution on a number of grounds. First and foremost, that it violates the non-delegation doctrine. Aiken, the primary case that they cite as striking down a Missouri statute on non-delegation, Aiken says that, look, you can't delegate the ability to make a law, but you can make reference to external indices. You can incorporate how the law is going to be executed. That's exactly what the commission did here. Law is a collective expression of policy. The commission said, we want our judges paid under this framework. That's it. And all they did was use an external index to empower that. Finally, under Fix, the decision cited by Moser's in Ratcliffe for the definition of Fix was overturned, abrogated by this court in a subsequent decision. And this didn't make it into our brief, and we'll submit it via letter to the clerk's office. And this is my responsibility, and I apologize. But in GIST, G-I-S-T versus Ratcliffe, 224-MO-369-1909, this court, en banc, abrogated that decision and adopted a much more flexible definition of the term fix that directly refutes Moser's arguments and directly refutes the stringent requirement that Moser's is asking this court to adopt. I see I'm out of time. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. The plaintiff's damage claim against the state of Missouri is based not on any error committed at the time the state or its officials acted, but on the notion that the state and its officials are under an obligation to retroactively change these actions due to subsequent events. The circuit court correctly concluded that this unusual monetary claim was barred by sovereign immunity, and second, that it is not based upon a correct interpretation of Article 13, Section 3.8 of the Constitution. The plaintiffs argue that this court should infer a waiver of sovereign immunity in this case to allow their damage claim to proceed because it's necessary, in their words, to enforce the compensation schedule adopted by the Citizens Commission pursuant to the Constitution. But the question of whether enforcement, even of a constitutional provision against the state, requires a damage claim against the state or a damage remedy was what this court specifically addressed in the Fort Zumwalt case. And as this court held, enforcement does not mean that we should automatically infer a waiver of sovereign immunity to allow a monetary judgment against the state of Missouri. Now, Fort Zumwalt involved the Hancock Amendment, as plaintiff's counsel said, but he then refers to the title of Section 23 of the Hancock Amendment, that's Article 10 of the Constitution. The title, though, while it does talk about interpretation, is not part of the Constitution itself. I understand that as the reviser of statutes does so for statutes, I understand that they put titles on constitutional provisions as well. So the language interpretation in Section 23 of Article 10 is really not part of the constitutional provisions of the Hancock Amendment. All the body of Section 23 says is that taxpayers may sue to enforce the amendment. Matter of fact, if you go back and look at the title in the session laws of 1980, when the Hancock Amendment was first published after its approval in the November election of 1980, you'll find that Section 23 had a different title. It simply said taxpayers may sue. It didn't say may sue for interpretation. Somewhere along the line, that got added and changed later.
You're saying the salary was and should be considered to be $127,000, what I'm trying to figure out is the extent of your sovereign immunity argument. say that someone was entitled to $100,000 pay and they were paid $75,000 for by mistaken scrivener's error or whatever, somehow there was a mistake, and everybody conceded that's what they were entitled to. Could they sue for the $25,000 they weren't paid that they were entitled to for that job?
Well,
or would sovereign immunity bar that suit, are you saying?
I think, you know, when you say they are entitled to, I think there you have the
I'm not talking just about the, our case. I'm trying to see where your argument leads. So say you hired someone at a salary, or in this case, say there was no beer, anything else. The person, the plaintiff retired at a salary of $127,000, and they were only paid based on $117,000 because the state miscalculated. Could they sue for any excess dollars they were entitled to, or would sovereign immunity bar that suit under your argument?
In the hypothetical you're stating, where it's a set amount and it isn't paid, probably you could get a mandamus. And I think that's
not barred by sovereign immunity because it's an obligation of the state. It's not a tort claim.
And you know, that I think is where the distinction lies between the cases that they cite in their briefs about getting a salary, you know, a back salary, where, you know, you have something that's legally, you know, determinable at the time. Maybe there's an open question about how to interpret a statute as to what the compensation is, but it is something that's legally determinable. And that's what makes this so troubling, Your Honor. At the time, this was not determinable. They do not allege
And why is that a distinction for sovereign immunity purposes?
Well, because there is no actual enforcement mechanism here in terms of a damage remedy, and I think this is really what they plead, and I think it is a damage remedy. And it's not something that should be inferred. I mean, we have here an implied, as they say, an implied action to enforce. That was something that was explicit in Hancock. And yet this court said that doesn't automatically mean that we should infer a damage remedy when that's not necessary to enforce the right.
But the structure was set up with the constitutional HGR 7, and it was voted on by the legislature as being put, the structure set up for the commission to have a percentage of the federal salaries, which is not determinable because you don't know what the federal salaries are going to be. So there wasn't an exact amount then, but the people of Missouri voted that it is a constitutional amendment when the salary was indeterminable from the start, and set up a system where the legislature could reject the commission's report, which they did not do.
Well, when you say not determinable, maybe in 2010, and they said we'll put this into effect starting for fiscal year 2013, maybe it wasn't exactly determinable then. But on the first day of the fiscal year 2013, it ought to be determinable. And in fact, there is no allegation here that salaries as they were set up on July 1, 2012, were not the appropriate percentage of what federal judges were being paid at the time. The whole gist of the plaintiff's claim is the federal government messed up and didn't apply, you know, with their own law as to determining what federal judges were being paid. But in this case, the state officials looked at, you know, planned for, budgeted for, and appropriated for the appropriate percentage of what the federal judges were being paid at the time. And now they're saying you've got to go back and retroactively change that because the federal government messed
but
up.
But the interpretation was it didn't stop at this, the point at which the Constitution changed. It was supposed to go forward as a percentage of federal salaries. That was never challenged as far as it going forward. So in 13 and 14, 15.
Well, of course it goes forward, Your Honor, but on each day of each fiscal year when the state is supposed to be acting and setting into place new salaries, it ought to be determinable. And now they're saying we can't trust what the federal government did. The federal government made a mistake here.
But the people of Missouri took the appropriation power away from the legislature on the commission. That was, as indicated, the change the Weinstock opinion.
I'm not sure quite what you're meaning when you say took away the appropriation power. But
before the commission would come up with proposals and the legislature would say, we don't have the money, we're not going to pay it. That's all.
Well, I think that reads far too much in and goes too far and really doesn't address the issues we need to focus on here. Based upon what this court said in Weinstock, The presence of that phrase in the original version of 3.8 was that there was no enforceable right if there hadn't been an appropriation. That was then removed, and as counsel said. So by implication, I can't really concede, as they said, a point of law. That's for this court. But, you know, it implies now that there is a right to enforce, regardless of whether there is an appropriation or not. But they don't allege that there wasn't an appropriation. They're alleging now that we need to go back for 2 years and change what that was. And I think that's just not really consistent with a proper interpretation, quite apart from sovereign immunity, not a proper interpretation of Section 3.8.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, I'd like you to turn your argument to that point. Leave aside sovereign immunity. Okay. Assume those are enforceable. Right. What is the right?
Well,
the word index is used multiple times in the 2010 schedule. How do we know whether that was meant to index daily or on a fiscal year basis?
I don't think, Your Honor, you know, that it would be a reasonable interpretation to change daily. I mean,
and why not?
Well, I think we look at what Section 3.8 says. It first says that if the legislature doesn't disapprove it within a month, I believe it is, then it becomes effective. But then it goes on to say that compensation schedule will then apply and represent the compensation of the appropriate officials, which includes judges as well as all other officials covered, the beginning of the next fiscal year. And so it references the beginning of a fiscal year. And this court in Weinstock said that Section 3.8 has to be read in conjunction with other parts of the Constitution unless they just absolutely cannot be harmonized. I think there are other parts of the Constitution here that relate to this issue. One, we have Article 4, Section 23, about the state's fiscal year system, appropriations being on fiscal year basis, that appropriations will expire 6 months after the end of a fiscal year. The entire state's financial system is set up on a fiscal year basis. The language of 3.8 references the start of this at a fiscal year. And if we go back and look at prior compensation schedules before the 2010, we see that the commission itself made its compensation schedules always on a fiscal year basis.
But can you address opposing counsel's argument that numerous federal courts have addressed this issue under federal law in dealing with bankruptcy judges and court of claims and so forth, and they found that what the salary was different than what had been written in at that time, but they didn't retroactively increase the salary. They corrected the statement of salary. So miscalculated for reasons beyond your control doesn't mean you didn't miscalculate.
Well, I don't know about the particular wording of the federal statutes, but I see no reason why there's any controlling
feature. Well, they were addressing what you're addressing, as you know, so could you directly address that? They said this is what their salary was on that date.
Well, I think the question here is, what does Section 3.8 mean when it talks about it being in effect, and then also the language it applies and represents? And it does so on a fiscal year basis.
Can you specifically address the federal cases for me, though, please?
Well, I don't think the federal cases control here at all. I think.
Can you address their reasoning and why it doesn't?
I think they're wrong, at least in terms of our law. Whether they're a proper interpretation of federal law, I think, you know, we're talking about federal judges, bankruptcy judges, district judges. You know, we're not talking about an applicant. You know, a principle of federal law on the U.S. Constitution that would apply here. It simply does not apply here. We need to look to the plain language of Section 3.8, which here I think is on a fiscal year basis.
Before 2006, I would have felt you're absolutely right on the three branches of government. The legislature appropriates, the executive does its job, the judiciary, and it seems to be grafted onto our legislation. But it was intentional to do so, and the people voted on it. But your point of view on the right to appropriate is the legislative. Generally, in every context, the legislature appropriates. However, we had a constitutional amendment, HCR 7, that we, the people, did that changed that. I mean, I think you have a very good position in that regard, and I would have felt the same way before 2006.
Well, I think the removal of the phrase, you know, appropriate, you know, subject to appropriation, you know, doesn't answer the question whether they get a damage action here. I think that just does not answer that question.
Thank you.
But in essence, as Judge Stith was alluding to, you're asking the correcting of the index. You're not necessarily asking, it's not necessarily, and it's a, maybe technical, back wages. It's a, or back salary, to an extent that you're correcting the index for purposes of retirement, and also that the federal government changed its measure, and we said we're going to follow that.
Alan Allred with Thompson Coburn here on behalf of the Missouri State Employees Retirement System, Mosers. Judge Teitelman, I agree. And in the case of the party against Mosers, Judge McGraw, I want to tell you why Judge Conley was right, and I want to tell you she has no claim against Mosers. The statute 476.530 says, and established under the Russell case that I argued in the Western District, at the time of retirement, you get 50% of your salary. When Judge McGraw chose to retire in October of 2013, she was earning, at that time, $127,000. And that's based on 73% of $174,000 under the commission. Fine. And that's what we based her retirement on. And that's what she received. That is exactly what Mosers did.
But her argument is that she was earning something differently, and that, therefore, she should have been paid more. I know you tell us why that's an incorrect argument, because the argument is, in fact, her salary was higher,
because,
even though we didn't know it till later.
Judge Stith, if you look at the schedule, and still today, and it's incorporated in appellant's brief and in their amended petition, still stated today what the salary was on 2013, and this is November of 2015, $174,000. Was the basis upon which Mosers based her salary, which is what it was. And if to go to your point, if I can anticipate, look at Beers and Barker. Fine. What about it? The federal law has been all over the lot. Look at the Williams case, which you're familiar with. In 2001, they said this was right about the COLAs. And by the way, this is a COLA. 3.8 says you can't have a COLA unless all state employees get it. You can't single out the judges. They're not saying, oh, I guess maybe they're advocating all state employees should get that COLA now, that the federal court decided that the federal judges should get. But that's not before the court. We're not arguing against the constitutionality of this statute, just the opposite. If you adopt what they're claiming, then the statute becomes unconstitutional because you have a violation of 3.8 in Article 13 specifically, with your delegating of that authority to the vagaries of the U.S. District Court, which is not what the citizens of Missouri anticipated. And so for those reasons, I think also if you take a look at some of the cases, the Planned House Houndsman case, the Thompson case, that's exactly what you previously looked at and said, we can't do that. Because it then submits our taxpayers to the whims and the whimsies of whatever the U.S. District Court or a federal court of appeals judge would choose to do.
But there is the vagaries of the federal district court and the vagaries of the United States Supreme Court when they don't is the law of the land. I mean, we are bound by whatever the federal, and if we're looking at, if the people of Missouri said, we are going to follow the federal court system, because it's, for whatever reason, the people of Missouri voted that, then we follow it. And if $127,000 wasn't her real salary because there was a mistake, not a mistake, a problem in law, as we know, the derivation of this deal was that the federal judges were getting outside income, and in order to eliminate much of the outside income, they said, we'll give you a cost of living and eliminate some of the outside income. That's because the judge is supposed to get paid, not to have the salaries reduced, and get paid for life at the same salary. And that was the way it was set up. And then the Congress decided not to give the cost of living, and the Beers case said they couldn't do that.
And then they turned around and said, you can't. And remember, they took the COLAs away. And then later, other Congress said, we're not going to allow COLAs for judges. Then they overturned that.
Well,
so
because
the point is, I would just say, Your Honor, that if we're going to go with this constitution of our state, which, of course, binds our court sitting in front of me, then there ought to be a finding in the federal court someplace that says that Article 13, Section 3.8, is unconstitutional. We're not arguing that it is. We're just saying we have to live by it.
Are there other questions? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Judge.
May it please the court. Just starting off, there's nothing in the 2010 compensation schedule that expressly prohibits state judicial salaries to adjust during the fiscal year. In fact, the plain language talks about the salaries beginning on the first day of the fiscal year, but not as of the first day of the fiscal year. But what really strikes me about this case is exactly how much the parties can agree on. You know, for example, there's no dispute that federal judges weren't just receiving incorrect pay, they were receiving unlawful and unconstitutional pay when the 2010 schedule was enacted. There's no dispute about that. There's also no dispute that the schedule applies and operates so that Missouri judicial salaries will adjust as federal salaries adjust, because it's happened already. It happened in 2014, it happened again this year, and it happened under this very same 2010 compensation schedule. And again, as has been referenced, there's no dispute that Judge McGraw and Judge Jones have not just a right, but an enforceable right to the full compensation they're due under the schedule. And so what it really comes down to is, do they have a remedy by which to enforce that right? Respondents say they don't. But in order to get there, they have to ask this court to either declare the entire compensation schedule unconstitutional, or they have to ask the court to overturn the law on the immunity of the state.
Following Judge Stith's excellent question about what if there's, forget the statute and the Constitution, what if the salary was mistaken, that she received 127 and she should have received 140? Does sovereign immunity protect the state from that?
I don't think it can protect the state from that, because for there to be a right, there has to be a remedy. And this court looked at that exact issue in the DiCarlo case, and that was on a contract issue. This is a stronger issue. This is a statutory pay rate based on a constitutional provision. It's not just a contract with a highway contractor. This represents an employee contract. Judges perform a service and a duty for the state, and in return they are paid a compensation promised to them by the Constitution and implemented under the schedule. And so there absolutely has to be a remedy and a right to recover monetary damages for wrongfully withheld back pay. DiCarlo says that has to be the result, because if it's not, you have to assume bad faith on the part of the legislature, and we can't do that. The legislature wasn't acting in bad faith. And so what we've asked for is a narrow, fact-specific application of this unanimous series of 10 cases, all awarding monetary damages for back pay in this exact same circumstances, and simply upholding Missouri's longstanding precedent on immunity law. And at the end of the day, this court has to look back to its statement in DiCarlo. And it said in DiCarlo, the very antithesis of responsibility by government would be to say that the state can offer a benefit, confer right, but then say, you know what, we breach, but you can't do anything about it.
Are there any questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
I thought the argument was very well argued on all sides. Thank you.
Thank you. The case was well argued. Thank you both.